Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How well do we handle our mistakes? Does an effort to avoid them actually make us less likely to perform to the best of our ability? Although stories of great inventors and innovators often contain accounts of all the times they failed before achieving their success, my guest has learned that our culture is remarkably intolerant of mistakes and that the fear of failure can actually serve as a check on ambition and healthy risk-taking. Journalist Alina Tugend writes the Shortcuts column for the New York Times. Her new book is called Better by Mistake, The Unexpected Benefits of Being Wrong. Alina, welcome to Think.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here.
We should start by talking about what can be fairly considered a mistake, because these days the word is used for everything from accidental oversights to felony offenses. Can you talk about your definition?
You're right. The trouble is that we, you know, leaving a sponge in a patient can be a mistake, and forgetting your daughter's piano recital can be a mistake. Mm-hmm. So I think that we don't have many gradations of mistake in our society. Definitions that came up with was misjudgments and adverse consequences that were unplanned, mm-hmm. or the failure of a planned sequence of mental or physical activities to achieve the intended outcome. Those are kind of the technical definitions.
So this started for you with a relatively minor mistake that you'd made in one of your columns. It was a spelling error, as it happens. Can you talk about what happened when you discovered that you'd made that mistake?
Yeah, I was mad. My readers are very good at pointing out mistakes, and I was not happy when I found it out. My first reaction was to try to figure out a way that it wasn't really a mistake. It was, you know, someone else had gotten it wrong. And then I was, oh, do I really need to correct it? It's so minor. And finally, I do. We're a newspaper of record, and it has to be publicly corrected. So I told my editor, who was very understanding, and we ran a public correction. But it got me thinking, why do I hate mistakes so much? Why is it that we're taught when we're young, in order to learn, we need to make mistakes, but then we grow up into people who hate and dread mistakes?
What's so interesting about your account, and we'll get in a little bit to the differences between men and women, is that I would imagine that if a colleague had made the same mistake you made, you would have said, not a big deal, just correct it and move on. But it was something that really stuck with you.
It's true. And I think you're right. We'll talk about men and women, but often if you have a certain type of temperament, which many of us do, you beat yourself up much harder than you beat other people up for the mistakes. And that's certainly the case with me. And again, it wasn't substantive. It wasn't something that I didn't libel someone. Nobody died. But it was the fact that, and I kept thinking, well, how did that happen? Why didn't I know it? And I think this runs into the problem that I talk about, and is that we have this myth of perfection. We all say, oh, to err is human and nobody's perfect. But somehow many of us deep down think we really should be flawless.
And we love this idea that the geniuses among us are people who just sort of sprang fully formed into existence.
That's right. And I think that this is another ongoing problem in our culture, is that we tend to, I mean, we sort of, again, a lot of this, what I'm saying, people are going to go, duh, I know this. But it's not that we don't say these platitudes. It's that we don't believe them. And I think what you said about geniuses is a perfect example. We all know practice, 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 or we all say that. But when we watch a great athlete or a great piano player, too many of us believe that somehow it's just someone, yeah, sure, he or she may practice, but somehow they just got it. They got it, and they're brilliant, and that's the way it is. And if we believe that, then we don't think mistakes have any place in our culture, because it does. You either got it or you don't, and no matter what you do, it's not going to change.
So why do we tell our kids, hey, everybody makes mistakes, if we have so much trouble walking the talk ourselves?
Because I think we really want to believe it. Mm-hmm. I think I tell the anecdote in my book about how a mother asked her kindergartner when she picked him up, did you learn anything today? And he said, no. And she said, you didn't learn anything? And he said, no, my teacher said I learned by making mistakes, and I didn't make any today. And that's a great anecdote, but the trouble is, after about kindergarten or first grade, most of us, you know, it would be great if we thought about all the ways we made mistakes at the end of the day and be not feel horrible about it, but be sort of, yeah, and this is what I learned from it. But I think our culture, for many reasons, we revere results, the test scores, the A's, the awards, the getting into the good college and the great job, and we don't look at the process. So this is why it's so hard for us to walk the walk.
Well, and what's interesting in these times is that the stakes get high almost immediately after kindergarten. Suddenly, it really matters, you know, as kids are trying to get into this school and that school, and there's this whole progression that starts just unimaginably young.
And that's what's sad. I think someone asked me, this is sort of changes when we become young adults. I said, no, it really changes much earlier, this fear of mistakes. And I think when results are all that matter, and I'm not trying to minimize that. I'm not trying to say we shouldn't care about it. I have a 10th grader. I care about that he gets into a college that he wants to. I care that he gets decent grades. But when it becomes all about that, when we don't anymore see what that effort and that learning is part of it, when it's only about how well you do, then again, mistakes only highlight failure. They don't do anything else.
And I'm sure you can relate to this as well as a parent. We've gotten to this place where if our kids are allowed to fail at something, somehow it seems like we have failed, like we should have prevented them and made them successful at whatever they tried to do.
I think that's a great point. Do you have children?
I have four.
Can I ask? Mm-hmm. Chris?
I do, yes.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I just was curious because I think that, especially as parents, as you said, we are so focused on making sure they don't feel uncomfortable, they don't feel unhappy, that they are successful in everything, that we forget a really basic lesson that life isn't really like that, and that far more important than feeling good all the time is learning how to fail and pick yourself up again, mm-hmm. and being resilient. And I think somehow, I think it's coming back a little bit, but we lost that in our culture somehow over the last few decades.
It was really interesting to me to read what social scientists have learned about this whole self-esteem movement, which is that you cannot, despite the best efforts of many well-intentioned people, apply self-esteem to another individual.
Well, that's it. And I mean, this started in California around the 60s, and I think it was very well-intentioned and probably had very good idea behind it, which is you don't want to tell kids you're stupid, you're dumb. You certainly don't want to sit there and put kids down. And so the idea was this is how we improve their self-esteem. But it somehow changed and I think got a little warped into this idea that we can give kids this. If we just tell them often enough how good they are, if we give a star, if we tell everyone they're special, if we give them trophies for every Little League game or every basketball game, they'll feel good. Well, it turned out that's not true, that you really can't just tell people they're good and they'll feel good. First of all, it doesn't work. And secondly, kids get cynical very easily. The real thing is to get self-esteem, we need to master things. We need to feel accomplished and competent. And we need, again, going back to resilience, we need to be able to fall down and stand up again and make mistakes. That's what gives us self-esteem.
Reading the book made me think of when some new neighbors moved into our neighborhood when I was a teenager, and the parents were Chinese immigrants, and their daughters were extremely accomplished. They had just done everything perfectly. And I remember saying to my neighbor, "Your daughters must be so smart." And he said, "No, they just work very hard." And at the time, that seemed like a put down. And now, you know, so as the years go on, it makes a lot more sense to me. But it's a cultural thing, too, isn't it, in this country?
It is very much a cultural thing. I'd like, if you don't mind, I'll get into the cultural aspect of it, but because the Hymn of the Tiger Mother has received so much publicity, the memoir written by the Chinese American author mm-hmm. and law professor who really pushed her children toward perfectionism, it sounds somewhat like your neighbors. And when I first heard about this and read the articles and saw the interviews, I thought this is not what I want at all. This is someone who thinks nothing is, you know, your children cannot fall short in any way. Everything must be first place. But one thing that really struck me later as I was thinking about it more and heard more interviews is she talks about her children coming from a place of strength. She believes they can do far more than they think they are capable of. Mm-hmm. And too many parents think their children come from a place of fragility, that they have to be protected. And that really struck a chord with me, that when we think they're fragile, we don't think they can venture out or be challenged. And that doesn't do anyone any good. But I'd be happy if you want me to talk about the cultural differences that I talk about in my book.
Well, and actually, we'll get to that in a minute, but the point that I was trying to get to was one that you also make, which is that praising the intelligence of children may not be the right thing. Praising their efforts tends to have a better outcome.
Absolutely. Carol Dweck, a Stanford psychology professor, has done groundbreaking research in this area, and she is sort of the pioneer in looking at how mistakes affect children and adults and how we respond to them. And one of the experiments she did was she took 400 fifth graders, and they were given a test. And half of them were praised for doing really well on the test by being really smart. They were told, man, you are so smart. The other half were praised for their effort, saying, you really put a lot of effort. Well, then the next step is they were given a test. They were given a choice of tests after that, either an easy one that they would probably do well on but wouldn't really challenge them, or a hard one that they may not do well on but they would really be taking some risk. Almost all the children praised for being smart chose the easy test so they wouldn't look dumb. Almost all the children praised for making an effort chose the more difficult test and challenged themselves.
So essentially, if we tell them they're smart, they're then afraid of proving us wrong.
I think that's right. I think that if you know, and I think most parents do at some point say, you're so smart, and I don't think that's horrible, but I think we have to really be aware of where we're putting the emphasis in our children. And if I think when you are told you're smart, you are afraid of looking dumb, and one way you potentially, quote-unquote, look dumb is by taking risks and stepping outside your comfort zone and not necessarily knowing all the answers.
And then even as adults, Alina, we have essentially two different mindsets. There are the fixed mindset and the growth mindset in terms of our ability to recover from mistakes.
That's correct. And this, again, goes back to Professor Dweck's researching, and it's now been adopted in many areas. She talks about those who have a fixed mindset. That's people who believe ability is innate, a little what we talked about before, that people are good at something or not. They're either good at music, they're good at science, they're good at baseball. For those people, mistakes do nothing but highlight their problems, highlight their failures. Because if you're good at something and you make a mistake, you're dumb, you failed. But if you have a growth mindset and you believe that you can develop and change over time, that doesn't mean we're all going to be top rock stars or athletes, but it means we can do a lot more than we think we can. The mistakes are a process. They're a way of learning more. And fixed mindsets, we tend to sell ourselves short. Growth mindsets, we tend to be able to take the risk we need to do in order to move up further, to take that one more step.
And having that fixed mindset that we are as smart as we're going to be or as talented as we're going to be, sort of regardless of our efforts, also makes us more likely to try and cover up when we have messed something up.
Exactly. It makes us more likely to cover up when we've messed up. It also makes us more likely to finger point, and it makes us more likely to judge others more harshly, because instead of seeing mistakes as, okay, let's look at this and see how we can change, it's like, boy, are you dumb. Mm-hmm. Boy, you screwed up. I mean, it works both ways.
And then if we're covering up mistakes, it's much harder to fix them and move on.
Well, that's it. We don't learn anything. I mean, once we decide that I'm going to ignore this mistake, we don't look and say, what caused it? What was the systemic problem behind it? Instead, we scurry away from it. We throw it into someone else's lap, and we ignore it. And it also makes us much less open to any kind of feedback that's potentially negative, even if it's constructive, because again, we don't think, oh, we'll learn from this feedback. What we think is, this person's telling me I'm stupid.
My guest this hour is journalist Alina Tugin. She writes the Shortcuts column for The New York Times. Her new book is called Better by Mistake, The Unexpected Benefits of Being Wrong. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can get on the phone lines at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's summer youth programs. Camps in computers, writing, art, math, science, and Legos held at SMU in Plano and on the main campus in Dallas. You can learn more at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Alina Tugin. She writes the Shortcuts column for the New York Times, and her new book is called Better by Mistake, The Unexpected Benefits of Being Wrong. Join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Alina, another thing that happens when people make mistakes is that they are so afraid of being punished that they end up denying them or pointing the finger elsewhere. Can you talk about what happens when people are scared that admitting their mistakes will get them in a lot of trouble?
I think one of the things they do is they do anything to avoid making mistakes, and that means playing it very safe. That means not trying anything new, not challenging themselves, not taking on new projects, not being innovative in any way, and not moving into fields, let's say in your personal life, not moving to any field where you might in any way make a mistake. And I think that is a huge problem in our society.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go on the phones to Cecilia in Dallas. Hi, Cecilia.
Hi.
Go right ahead, please.
Hi, this is Cecilia.
Hi, yes, go right ahead, please.
Thank you. Alina, thank you so much for writing your book. I really appreciate it.
Great.
I'm a recovering perfectionist, okay, and have lived through the corporate America environment of mistakes. It has cost me 6 jobs. My perfectionism led to panic attacks. I'm still paying the medical bills due to the physical ailments associated with panic attacks. And I was the problem was the gray area between efficiency and perfection. They loved my work, no problems, but, ooh, the deadline, you need to get quicker. And then I'd get quicker, and then I'd make a mistake, and I still lost the job. But on the positive thing, perfectionism, though, and mistakes, they can be your greatest teacher. That's an old saying, but it's so true. And I'm pursuing other opportunities, and that's all I can say. But corporate America, if you could touch on that.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you. I'll take it off the air.
Sure. I think that is a problem with corporate America. I think there are strategies I can discuss later if we want about how there are ways that supervisors and bosses can be taught to be more accepting and welcoming to mistakes. It's not easy. It depends what kind of mindset you have. I understand there is a bottom line in corporate America, but sometimes that bottom line is hurt if you're so willing to avoid mistakes. But if I just say something, I've heard that phrase, recovering perfectionist, and I think it's a great phrase. And I think perfectionism, there's many aspects of perfectionism that's good, of setting high standards. The trouble is when perfectionists think you can never fail, you can never make a mistake, and that to make a mistake is humiliation, that's when perfectionism does not serve us well at all.
What does it take for corporations to, let's move aside from corporations. You looked at two industries that in which the mistakes can have life or death consequences immediately. You looked at aviation and you looked at healthcare. Mm-hmm. What did you learn from that?
Well, what we learned, the medical field is actually learning from what aviation learned earlier, which is that as much as we want pilots and doctors to be perfect, they can't be. And there's going to be errors. And the question is, how do you handle those errors? And one of the things that we learned is that we really need to change things at the top and at the bottom. Inflexible hierarchies where people can never challenge or question, and that's very true in both aviation and medical field, creates an atmosphere where mistakes are hidden. And when mistakes are hidden, again, you can't come up with systemic ways to address them. This particular problem in the medical field where there a great deal of medical errors that lead to deaths are not from extreme bad rogue doctors who cut off the wrong leg or do something horrible, but from ongoing less dramatic things like infection control, and that was not addressed in the proper way in some cases because nobody looked at behind the errors, and there've been ways of addressing that, which I'll talk about. But in aviation, it was discovered that a lot of this had to focus on how teams of people work together well and how they communicate it well and whether a junior pilot could question a senior pilot and whether a senior pilot could admit to being stressed and having fatigue. This is just one example. There are many, many ways many aspects that were put into place to make sure that errors were as infrequent as possible.
And then when they were made, that the team could come together immediately and honestly to try and fix what the
Absolutely.
Problem was.
Absolutely. That's exactly right. And I think that they've learned, and it's been, aviation is a real success story in learning how to deal with errors and try to lessen them as much as possible.
And then jumping back over into healthcare, one of the things that has worked for hospitals is to create an environment in which a nurse who notices a doctor's error is encouraged to speak up rather than worrying that she'll be punished for embarrassing the doctor.
And again, this is a change in culture. Another aspect that has really worked in the medical field is something as simple as checklists. And this is a great example of how we think in the medical field there'll have to be technological changes or great advances in medicine. Well, no, a checklist, something we use in a grocery store. It was found doctors were doing too much from memory, and they were skipping steps, and this was causing, again, infection problems, which kill people. And so simple checklists, put on the sterile cloth, wash your hands, have saved so many lives. In one hospital, Johns Hopkins University Medical Center, where I went to, when they implemented these checklists in ICU surgical units, the infection rate dropped from 11% to zero. But one aspect of this is not just a checklist. You can't just hand people a checklist. You have to change the culture, and that's what's referring to what you said. You have to be able, if a nurse says, doctor, you skipped that point on the checklist, he has to be able to listen to her, and she can't be afraid, he or she can't be afraid to say it.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. You can also email think@kera.org to talk to Alina Tugend about her new book, Better by Mistake. Let's go on the phones now to Plano and speak with Rochelle. Hi, Rochelle.
Hi there. Yes, I just am very fascinated by this conversation. I am the child of teachers who were in college during the early 70s, mid-70s, and I'm the oldest child, and they kind of used me as a guinea pig when they were going to school. I have since become a teacher myself. When I was growing up, it was all about how brilliant I was, how intelligent, how gifted. I was in advanced classes in elementary school, middle school, and then when classes actually, and this was back in the 70s when you got an A or an A-plus or an A-minus on a report card, not a numeric grade, and I remember distinctly the first time I got an A and not an A-plus on my report card, I believe it was fifth grade or fourth grade, I just was hysterical, and then when I got into sixth grade sciences, and it was a little bit challenging, and I couldn't make a 99 or a 100, I had no coping skills because it had always been about how brilliant I was, and it was just a given. In my own mind, if I couldn't do the work, there must be something wrong with me. And now that I've become a teacher, I've been a teacher in a very progressive school district locally, and I have a three-year-old myself, I go out of my way to commend children on their efforts and try again and look at it in a different way and not focusing on how bright they are, and it just, I haven't read your book, obviously, yet, but could you touch on possibly the connection between perfectionism in children with parents who expect great things from them and depression? Because, again, when I realized I couldn't do everything right out of the gate, it caused a great deal of emotional distress for me and depression. And I'm just wondering if we're going to start seeing more and more of this as the stakes get higher and higher with the academic game stakes being raised.
Let's get an answer for you. Thanks for your call.
That's a great question, and I have to say I spoke to 600 teachers yesterday morning at a superintendent's conference and got so much of a similar response to this. Teachers see this so often, especially in affluent, let's say, areas where there's a lot of pressure to do well to get in a good college, and one teacher talked about how a student said to her, I know we learned this on a test. I know we learned this, and I can't remember the answer, and I don't want to struggle with it. And they also talked about how students panic on some of these standardized tests because they're not used to not knowing something, and they can't live with that feeling of not knowing anything. So they just kind of move on, and they can't answer the questions. And I think we really need to teach our children how to live with the uncomfortable feeling of not knowing something, and realizing they can learn it, and that because they don't get something right away, it doesn't mean they're dumb, they're stupid, or you know, they just have to sort of run out of the room. And I think teachers, yes, they have so much pressure on them to teach to the test, to do all this, but it's such an important area. And I think I'd be curious, I don't know if the caller's still on the line, how she did manage to recover her or to get her resilience, because what she's talking about is resilience. She had no resilience to understand that when things don't go perfectly, it's okay.
So obviously we're not going to throw deliberate roadblocks up in front of our kids, but what's the first step in sort of pulling back a little bit and letting them succeed and fail for themselves?
I think the first thing is knowing we can't protect them from everything. They don't get invited to that birthday party that Susie invited all the friends to. They don't get the part in the play. We don't run out and try to fix it. We don't call the mom, Susie's mom, and say, you know, I wish you'd invited my daughter. And we don't talk to the teacher about getting the part in the play. We also don't say, referring to the part in the play or the place on the team, you deserved it. You were a superstar. I mean, maybe that's the case, and obviously it's a hard. I've come across it when my kids have not gone on teams they felt they should have. But we talk about it, why that could occur, and we say things like, you know, it's a shame, and if you did put out a left effort, that's great. Let's work on it. So maybe next time you'll have. Maybe next time you'll get it. We can't promise them, but maybe next time you'll get it. We don't rush in, because it's really hard when your kid's sitting there heartbroken and crying about something. But we don't try to. I've heard stories of parents when their kids don't get the grade they expect, calling the parents and demanding to know why not. Young kids. And I think we really, really need to be aware of the harm we're doing to our children.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. You know, the other thing about that, Alina, is that you're also essentially communicating once again to the child that the grade is unacceptable, that if you got an 80 on something that you hope to get a 90 on, by calling the teacher, it's saying, well, it wasn't okay that you brought home this 80.
Exactly. You're also telling the kid, we don't think you're strong enough to handle this.
Yeah. Let's go back to the phones now. This time we will speak with Ed in McKinney. Hi, Ed.
Hey. Nice program.
Thanks.
You had reference to the book Mindset.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Which my wife and I both read and enjoyed. We're sending it to our daughter so she can use it with our little grandson. But I wanted to remark about one thing that was not in her book, and I've not heard it mentioned here either. My wife happens to be a Montessori educator, and this concept of the growth mindset, praise for effort rather than smarts, you know, that sort of thing, has been around in the Montessori teaching profession for over 100 years. And I wonder if your guests might wish to add to that or whatever, and I will hang up and listen on the radio. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you. Yes, mine says he's referring to the book by Carol Dweck, the professor I've been referring to. And it is a good book. It's a great book. And it obviously refers to a lot of what I've been talking about. I'm a very, very small, very little knowledge of the Montessori system, but what I do understand is that is much more part of the learning process there, which I think is great.
So outside of the life or death workplace of healthcare facilities and flying planes, talk about how corporate cultures can remake themselves to make it possible for people to make mistakes and feel somewhat safe.
Well, I think that one of the things is to it's been shown, research has shown that if you teach people about these fixed and growth mindset, if you teach managers about it, if you run workshops, if you show them research, they tend to be more open about how they view their employees and how they view themselves, that they tend to be more open to the fact that the employee can change. They don't view mindset. They don't view all failures as mistakes as just failures. They view them as ability to learn. They also are less likely to see any kind of feedback as negative because they don't just see it as a judgment about themselves. They see it as an opportunity to learn. Another thing is double loop and single loop learning.
Mm-hmm.
This is something that Harvard professor Chris Argus has written a great deal about, which is all too often companies and corporations look at a mistake as a one-time thing, they fix it, either they punish the employee or they do whatever needs to be done and they move on. That's single-loop learning, and sometimes that's all that's necessary. But double-loop learning is a way that we don't just look at the problem, but look what's behind the problem and what caused it and why it was there and how can we fix it. And that's much more likely to be effective in the long term.
So, Alina, how are men and women different in the way, and of course we're generalizing, but in the way that we respond to our own mistakes and others' mistakes?
You're going to get me in trouble here, but I did write about it, so there you go. women, and again, you're saying the generalities, and I'm sure people will say that's not true for my husband or my wife, but generally speaking, women tend to beat themselves up more over mistakes. Again, some research, there's not a lot of research on this, but what there is shown that women tend to agonize, they tend to remember their mistakes much longer, they tend to use words like, I was so stupid, I was such a failure, it was a catastrophe. Men tend to move on, they tend to depersonalize the mistake, as we say. They tend to either blame others or blame the system or say, or just think, well, you know, I tried my best. They just weren't ready to hear my great new idea. And so we can learn from both of them. I'm not saying either one is the right way to approach things, but that's generally how it breaks down.
Do we tend to judge other people similarly to the way we judge ourselves?
I think you're right. I think we do. So I think, you know, it's an interesting question. I think sometimes, as you said at the beginning of the show, we're harder on ourselves than we are on others. But I think we've come from a highly critical home and we think that mistakes are really bad, we don't tend to have a lot of patience or a lot of understanding of the role mistakes can serve. I think if we're more willing and more open, then we are more willing and more open with other people.
Yeah, it seems to make sense, too, to sort of take a broader view as opposed to always assuming it's only the individual and think, what about the system in which this thing is done is not working?
Well, that's it. And again, to refer to research, it's shown that most mistakes are caused by a whole series of latent mistakes mm-hmm. leading up to the active error. It's not that one thing that you see, the plane crash. Rather, it's probably a design malfunction. And why was that caused? And what was wrong with the designers that led up to that? And then why couldn't the pilot control it? And that's just one example. In other workplaces, usually that's what we need to look at, but we don't because it's hard, because you sometimes have to ask difficult questions, and because it takes longer. And so, therefore, we solve the problem in the short term, but not the long term.
Alina Tugend is my guest. She writes the Shortcuts column for the New York Times and is the author of the new book, Better by Mistake, The Unexpected Benefits of Being Wrong. You can join our conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's summer youth programs. Camps in computers, writing, art, math, science, and Legos held at SMU in Plano and on the main campus in Dallas. You can learn more at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Alina Tugend. She writes the Shortcuts column for the New York Times, and her new book is called Better by Mistake, The Unexpected Benefits of Being Wrong. Join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Alina, in this country, we think of ourselves as so innovative and ambitious and open and friendly. Why then are we so mistake-averse?
Well, I think there's two trends that run throughout our culture. One is this Horatio Alger myth that anybody can, if they just work hard enough, they can make it in America. The other one is that somehow what people do is effortless, mm-hmm. as we talked a little bit before, that somehow if you're showing a lot of effort, that's not really what's America. America is you can just do it on your own. And I think we give lip service to the first one, that anyone can make it in America if you just work hard enough. And we really believe the second one, which is it's all about being effortless. We know that there's a practice, people have to practice, but we don't really believe it.
There are a lot of mistakes that after being corrected and even after being examined and analyzed for what should be done differently next time, still require an apology. And as you've discovered, there are some great apologies on record and there are some really horrific ones. What separates the two?
Well, we know that three things make a good apology: acknowledgement of the offense, expression of regret, and accountability, taking responsibility, if possible, a way to fix it. Unfortunately, too often, especially with public apologies, there's no, even if someone says I'm accountable, there's no sense they really are.
Mm-hmm.
A bad apology is someone, I think we're all familiar with this, is someone who says, I'm sorry you were so hurt.
I'm sorry you took it that way, right?
Yeah, it just implies you're so oversensitive.
Uh-huh.
Another bad apology is, someone who goes on and on about how bad they feel. This isn't about them.
Right.
You end up comforting them. A good apology has to be a dialogue, not a monologue. It has to acknowledge the injured person and really listen to what happened and express regret for it. It can't just be mouthing the words, it can't just be getting it off your chest.
Are we all just afraid that if we admit that we were truly wrong, that there will be additional consequences on us?
I think so. I think there's some of that. I think there's an element of feeling ashamed.
Mm-hmm.
I also think we aren't taught necessarily how to do good apologies. I mean, a lot of this we think should be so natural and so instinctive, but it's really not. It's really not. And especially when we have bad role models in the way many politicians and many of, unfortunately, we've seen so often from Tiger Woods and David Letterman or whatever, the apologies where it's a non-apology apology. So we really, I think in many cases, we don't know what a good apology and what actually taking responsibility for something means.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Victoria in Dallas. Hi, Victoria.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm an attorney, and I work with so many other attorneys who are just absolutely terrified when they make a mistake to tell a judge or to tell a client, look, I blew it, I'm sorry, I missed the court date, I'll do whatever it takes to make it right. My experience has been to do that, when I do that, and I was raised by my father had a great deal of integrity, and I was raised to own up and say, hey, I blew it, I'm sorry, I'll do whatever I have to do to make it better. I do that with my clients, I do it with judges, and across the board, never had a client file a grievance against me, never had a client threaten to take everything I own and sue me for everything I've got. I've consistently earned my client's respect and a judge's respect simply because I was not willing to cover up the mistake I made. And I think that's where politicians, Nixon and John Edwards, that's where they got in trouble. It was the mistake that was made that was bad enough, but it's the cover-up that everybody hates so much, and it is so damning.
What do you think about that, Alina?
I think it's a great point, and I want to say what she's doing is exactly right. There's some great, fascinating research in the medical field where, as we know, doctors are often terrified of admitting their mistake, not just because they may look stupid in front of their peers and patients, but because of medical malpractice. But what's been found, if doctors honestly and openly communicate with the patients and, if necessary, apologize, medical malpractice suits have actually gone down, not up.
Because sometimes what people want is an acknowledgement that they were wronged.
That's sometimes all they want. Too often doctors, and I'm speaking specifically of doctors, but I'm sure it's true of lawyers, deny and defend, as it's called. They don't even want to hear the problem, and they certainly don't want to hear that they're wrong. And some of it's because of our legal system, but some of it's because of the culture we've created in those professions. And too often people who may not even have thought of suing end up suing because they're so furious.
Another interesting thing in our society, and I don't know if you found research about this or not, but is the fact that authority figures don't get much opportunity to apologize to those beneath them. I don't know if that's out of a sense that somehow they will cede that authority if they say, I messed up on this thing or that thing.
That's interesting. I mean, one of the apologies I came through that I use as a good example is Warren Buffett. Now, I think he's pretty much an authority figure in our country, but he gave, I think it was last year probably, during his annual report when he said, I made some bad mistakes. It was my responsibility. I should have known better.
Mm-hmm.
And I used it because this stood out so much as an authority figure coming out and saying exactly the right thing, and that was the end of it.
Yeah, and everyone still respects him.
Exactly. I mean, nobody thinks, boy, this guy doesn't know what he's doing.
Let's go back to the phones again. This time, Matt in Dallas is on the line. Hello, Matt.
Hi. This is a really interesting topic, one that I'm sort of passionate about just because I think that so much in human interaction revolves around it. But I've noticed, at least for myself and other people that I know, that the act of apologizing, it costs you something. And I've also noticed it's almost like a small death, because it sort of represents the death of who you like to see yourself as. You know, we all like to see ourselves as people who will always be thoughtful and who will never do something petty. And when you actually do that and apologize and internalize what's going on in the mechanics of it, you have to accept the fact that you really aren't that person that you like to think of yourself as.
That's a really interesting point.
That's a great point. And if I may comment on that, I think the point is not that there's two thoughts I have. It's yes, at that moment we weren't the person we wanted to be. But by apologizing, and that goes back to we're not perfect and we're never going to be perfect, and sometimes we're going to do things we're ashamed of. But and that's what we have to remember. So when you talk about the small death, I think we need to remember that has to do with our image of ourselves being perfect. So we make a mistake, we apologize. But when we apologize, as an expert in this has said, we restore the moral universe.
Hmm.
Apologies aren't just for the other person, for the injured party. It's for us. When we've done a sincere and good apology, we are better people for it. And maybe you feel like, gee, I had to internalize that I wasn't as thoughtful or as good as I wanted to be. But by doing that apology, you've restored that in yourself.
Do we do more to help someone else not make a mistake in the future by forgiving them than by harshly criticizing when they say, I'm sorry, and you say, yes, and you did this, and this wrong, too?
Gee, you know some of the conversations I've had with my husband? yeah, I think that's true. In fact, research has also shown that sometimes we apologize too quickly. We do need to get, depending on how serious the injury is, sometimes we need to give people time to absorb and think about it and not rush in and say, forgive me, because, again, that's about you, not them. But I think ultimately, if we ask for forgiveness and the person can give it, you're more likely to feel, I can make a mistake in the future. I'm not perfect, but that doesn't mean I'm a bad person.
Let's go back to the phones this time. We'll speak with Jane in Plano. Hi, Jane.
Hi. How are you doing?
Great, thanks.
Good. I was just thinking, I listened to everybody's comments, which are really very, they're very enlightening in that, when you look at apologies and you look at attitude and accountability and responsibility and regret, a lot of it is that people are in denial. You know, people want to be, they want to be perfect, or they're too much of a perfectionist. They don't want to admit that they made a mistake, and you could never get an apology out of that person. And some people will never admit they're wrong. Some people will never admit that they've made a mistake. And that's, you know, I think the problem with, they put other people in a very, upsetting situation where they walk on eggshells trying to accommodate that person. And if you bring anything up, like even suggest that they did something wrong, they want to make you the bad guy, and they want to make you feel like you're accusing them. And it just becomes this vicious circle. And you see that with all these housewives shows. I mean, it's scary when you see the interaction between, and I see it a lot more with women than with men, because I watch the interaction and I'm thinking, wow, this is scary, you know, that people will, never even ever see that they've done anything wrong. And it's very frustrating for other people that have to deal with those people on a regular basis.
Thanks so much for your call, Jane. Yeah, Alina, I think we've all felt like we've been there.
Absolutely. I mean, we all know people like that. And unfortunately, if one of those people is your bosses, it's a really tough situation to be in. If it's a friend, that may be a friendship you need to walk away from. But I think those people who are like that have such an incredible fear of mistakes and of looking like they're flawed in some way that they can't bear it. And I think that's where that comes from.
We've got time for one more call. This time we'll speak with Vic in Irving. Hi, Vic.
Hi. I'm actually calling because I was listening earlier, and I noticed that you guys were talking about how in the school systems, a lot of parents kind of jump to the conclusion of blaming the teacher or the coach or whoever's in charge for not having their child up front. And I just kind of wanted to give my take as a Asian American. I believe I'm second generation. So my parents actually came to this country in the 70s. And one of the things that I actually noticed, the difference between the way I was raised and the way other people were raised, were my parents were actually very critical, but they were critical in the way that they made sure that they pushed you towards the educational aspects of it. They're like, oh, yeah, you know, do a recreation, do whatever. But, you know, even as my parents came to this country, you know, with very little money, and despite that fact, they made sure that no matter what they did, we're going to put you in these extra classes, even if it costs us, you know, a month or, you know, a week. We'll put you in this class instead of buying this thing for our kids. And I feel like that's kind of lost on the current American society. They're like, oh, you know, well, our kids don't really need this extra stuff. They can do without it. They'll learn it in the schools. Whereas I feel a lot of Asian American parents are like, hey, we're going to invest our money in our children, and we're going to make sure that they're on top of everything. And I feel like that's something that actually is kind of getting lost in the current American society, because I know before that's not how it used to be, because I've talked to, you know, friends of my dad and things like that, and when they were growing up in America, they're like, oh, our parents used to do this for us all the time, and now their parents really are like, me first, child second.
Yeah, Vic, I take your point. I think that's a little a field of where we were talking about mistakes, but is there anything you heard that you wanted to comment on, Alina?
Yeah, I mean, I understand his point, and I think it is a different way. I did write about culture in my book concerning especially Asian and American culture, and I think you're right. It is a very different cultural view of things. I write about it in a slightly different way, and I think it may be getting a little off point if I start trying to address that.
Let me ask you this. When you first wrote about this in your column, did you anticipate this flood of response that you had from people? You really touched a nerve.
Yeah, no, I didn't at all. I have to say, I like my readers. I certainly get readers who disagree with me. And as I said, nobody loves pointing out a mistake more than a reader. But I also was so delighted to get so many emails from people saying how grateful they were for this. And that really, that word struck me, that they just felt sort of a burden had been lifted up them, that this fear of mistakes and why they feared it and how it was so much a part of our culture made them understand themselves so much better.
Does it make it any easier for you, having done all this research now, to accept it when you've done something that you just can't believe you blew it?
The trouble is now people just, if I complain, they go, just read your book. But it, you know what makes it easier? It's not that I love mistakes. Mm-hmm. I still hate it. And I still make a mistake in my column once in a great while. Mm-hmm. And I may certainly make mistakes with my children and in life. What is easier is not that I sit there and go, yahoo, I made a mistake. But what makes it easier is the recovery process. I no longer spend endless hours beating myself up about it. I have absorbed some of the things I myself have learned about process and culture and taking risks, and how if I'm going to take any kind of risk, writing this book is a risk. I'm sure someone's going to point out mistakes.
Yeah.
But I took that risk, and that's okay.
Alina Tugin's new book is called Better by Mistake, The Unexpected Benefits of Being Wrong. Alina, thank you so much for spending this
hour
with us.
Thank you. It was a real pleasure.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.